There's no question that it's a significant number. Is it a windfall? Yes.
TV stations win big from campaign spending in the U.S. Senate race. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, November 13th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, warm weather causes an unusual November breakup on the Kuskokwim River.
It sounds like rocks moving. There's no needle ice like in the springtime to soften some of the sound.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
More than $57 million was spent on Alaska's U.S. Senate race, which comes out to about $230 per vote cast, and the campaigns aren't done reporting their spending totals. APRN's Liz Ruskin took a look at where that money went.
First of all, many of those millions never made it to Alaska. About a third of the total went to out-of-state companies for things like internet ads, robocalls, mailers, and strategic advice. What remained in Alaska was paid largely to local TV stations. More than half of the $40 million spent by super PACs and other outside groups bought airtime on Alaska's radio and TV stations. That doesn't include the $17 million the candidates spent through their own campaigns.
You know, the unreported story of these election cycle is how particularly electronic media gouges in the political cycle.
That's Jim Lotzfeldt, who spent $10 million through the Put Alaska First Super PAC to press for Senator Begich's re-election. He's sipping pina coladas in Hawaii this week, but he's still irked at what he had to pay to get his ads on air. While stations are required to give candidates their lowest rate, the same does not apply to other political advertisers. So, in the week before the election, the candidates paid just $450 for a 30-second spot on Anchorage TV News. Put Alaska First, along with its Republican counterparts, paid $7,500. Lotzfeldt says it's not right.
TV and radio stations just start adding zeros to the cost that they would charge any other customer. It's ridiculous.
Did you happen to watch the NFL game on the Sunday before the election? Put Alaska First paid Anchorage station KTUU a whopping $35,000 to run one 30-second spot during that game. Lotzfeldt says prices like that are a big reason campaign spending went so high.
When people talk about wanting to get all the big money out of politics, they should have an honest conversation with TV stations and radio stations.
Elizabeth Wilner, who analyzes campaign advertising for the research firm Kantar Media, says the situation may be exacerbated in Alaska because it lacks competition in local cable and in Anchorage has one especially dominant TV station.
Sometimes you'll get political advertisers trying to sort of get better rates by playing, you know, different platforms off one another. You can't do that in Alaska because you just don't have that many options.
KTUU General Manager Andy McLeod says he doesn't know yet exactly how much ad revenue the political season brought to his station.
There's no question that it's a significant number. Is it a windfall? Yes.
McLeod says KTUU reaped most of the total airtime buy because it's got by far the bigger audience, especially for local news. In fact, the station ran more Senate ads this cycle than any other station in the country. And McLeod's unapologetic about making money off political ads.
The political landscape is a revenue driver that happens every even year, sometimes large, sometimes small.
He says KTUU essentially reserves a slice of its ad time for the non-candidate political advertisers to avoid pricing regular customers and candidates off the air. Then it's an auction, and the well-funded political groups bid the rate higher and higher. McLeod says the cost of that airtime can't be compared to regular ads.
They really reflect the value of in this case, a Senate seat. They reflect the value of party control of the Senate.
TV stations didn't get all of the campaign money spent in state. Some of it paid for local workers, for hotels and rental cars, and for newspaper advertising. But all told, the checks outside groups paid to Alaskans other than broadcast stations came to about $3 million. In Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
Russia's already strained diplomatic relationship with the U.S. is degrading further amid renewed reports of a military presence in the Ukraine. But a conference underway in Anchorage this week is trying to work around sanctions and rhetoric in order to focus on mutual interests in the Bering Sea. As KSKA's Zachariah Hughes reports, the delegation from Russia is in Alaska to prepare for oil spills and increased marine traffic in the region.
It took Nikolai Kolyanto a week to fly to Anchorage from the Russian Far East, where he served as a member of the Chukotka Marine Mammal Hunters, or CHASTO, for a meeting on oil spills.
And our main concerns, or the main concerns of the hunters, are pollution of the environment and the potential effect of oil spills on the mammals' population and on the ecosystem's productivity.
Communities on the Chukotkin Peninsula have a lot in common with their counterparts across the Bering Strait, places like Diomede, Wales, and Savunga. They hunt the same animals for subsistence, and there's rising concern about a lack of preparation for industrial accidents as exploration and Arctic shipping increase. Edward Zador directs CHASTO and says he's hoping this conference can give communities more tools for accessing information that relates to oil spills.
There's no government support. The communities don't get any information about industrial activity. And it's something that is a big component of our work to make sure that the federal government and the companies do provide information about planned industrial activities.
The meeting was organized by the World Wildlife Fund, which has had an interest in Arctic environmental conservation for two decades. Margaret Williams directs WWF's Arctic program and says the non-governmental organization is able to maneuver around diplomatic roadblocks to bring together experts.
Because the Arctic is changing, because the sea ice is melting, the Bering Strait is going to experience more human activity. And so World Wildlife Fund has been working with partners in Alaska and Russia to identify ways we can plan for that increased human activity, ways that we can reduce risk.
The U.S. has limited capacity for spill response in the Arctic, but Russia has less, even as they're ramping up Arctic oil and gas development faster than the U.S. And according to Alexei Kniznikov, who tracks the extraction industry for WWF from Moscow, sanctions have halted one of the biggest benefits that international oil projects have brought to Russia in the past.
I mean, for us, for environmentalists, it's bad because many Western companies brought better standards for environmental safety.
The worsening political climate has also halted cooperation between federal agencies on both sides, who were now barred from even engaging in dialogue. So while the U.S. Coast Guard used to work with their Russian counterparts, this week officials were only allowed to attend the meetings as observers. Williams with WWF is hoping the conference can put technical experts and regional players in contact so they can begin coordinating spill prevention and response measures. That already exists on the ground to some extent, says Gay Sheffield, a biologist with UAF's Marine Advisory Program. She says Bering Strait communities are working more frequently with health officials to report the growing number of irregular wildlife incidents.
Our community members have been the first responders. So for all the environmental anomalies that have been happening, sick seals, sick birds, unusual wildlife, and oiled wildlife, in all cases, those were communicated and discovered by coastal community members actively engaged in subsistence activities.
The conference wraps up Friday with one-on-one discussions, and though they live just a few hours west of Nome, the Chukotkins will be flying east for the next several days. In Anchorage, I'm Zachariah Hughes.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, Pavlov Volcano puts on a show as it erupts for a second time this year.
All of a sudden it just started glowing red and it just started erupting and it just stayed a big giant ball of red flame and lava coming up out of the mountain.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking rope, chain, and boat anchors from 5 to 3,000 pounds on the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's business dreams grow for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC.
Pavlov Volcano is awake again on the Alaska Peninsula. KUCB's Annie Ropeek has more on the new eruption.
Ash began rising from Pavlov's summit on Wednesday afternoon. Since then, the Alaska Volcano Observatory has seen seismic activity ramping up there too, and lead scientist John Power says they've confirmed that Pavlov is erupting.
There is a minor amount of ash being thrown out as high as possibly 9,000 feet, and our satellite imagery indicates that there is a very hot ground, most likely associated with lava fountaining taking place at the summit of the volcano.
Ron Bowers is from Dillingham, but he's in Cold Bay right now, about 40 miles from Pavlov. He watched the eruption starting on Wednesday night.
It was just an awesome display. What a light show. And the ash is really coming, pouring out toward the east, from the east side of the mountain. And all of a sudden it just started glowing red and it just started erupting and it just stayed a big, giant ball of red flame and lava coming up out of the mountain.
That kind of activity could go on for several weeks or months with varying levels of intensity. Historically, Pavlov's been one of the most active volcanoes in the state, but John Power at the AVO says it's not very predictable.
What we saw earlier this year is probably our best guide to what we'll see this time.
Pavlov erupted for about a week this past June, sending up an ash plume to more than 20,000 feet above sea level. That caused regional airlines to cancel a string of flights. Grant Aviation and Penn Air say the ash from Pavlov hasn't gotten in their way yet this time, but bad weather has. Some flights were delayed and even grounded this week. Representatives from both companies say they'll be monitoring the volcano closely. In Unalaska, I'm Annie Ropeek with help from Dave Benninger in Dillingham.
After years of financial difficulties, Horizon Lines is breaking up. The shipping company has announced plans to shut down or sell its domestic routes, including service to Alaska. KUCB's Lauren Rosenthal has more.
Horizon started moving cargo in Alaska 50 years ago. Back then, the company was still known as Sealand, and they hadn't gone through the string of mergers and sales that have become common in the shipping industry. As Horizon has changed hands, it's been stacking up debt, more than $500 million worth. Chief Financial Officer Michael Avera says they tried refinancing and then restructuring, but the company still wasn't sustainable. That's why Horizon has decided to shut down operations in Puerto Rico and sell the rest. In Hawaii, a shipping line called the Pesha Group has offered $142 million to pick up Horizon's service. And for $69.2 million, Matson will get the Alaska operations and all of Horizon's stock. Avera says they're in a good position to take it on.
Matson is a large, profitable company with roots tracing back 150 years or so. They have an excellent balance sheet, and I think they'll be a very good steward of the Alaska service.
Until now, Matson's mostly been focused on shipping in Hawaii. They wanted to expand north, but spokesperson Jeff Hull says there wasn't room until Horizon fell on hard times. The company was part of a long investigation into price fixing in the cargo industry. In 2011, Horizon pleaded guilty to inflating their rates and agreed to pay a $15 million fine. The Justice Department also asked Matson to produce records, but they were never charged with a crime. Even though Horizon has been on shaky footing, they've still been a major player in domestic shipping under the Jones Act. The law says operators have to be American-owned, using domestically built vessels and American crews in order to move cargo between U.S. ports. Horizon has more than a dozen vessels that meet those standards, including three in Alaska. Together, they serve Tacoma, Anchorage, Kodiak, and Unalaska.
And basically, they are carrying our fresh produce, our groceries, household goods.
That's Peggy McLaughlin, Unalaska's ports director. Horizon has been using the same municipal dock in Unalaska for more than 20 years. For most of that time, they operated under a special contract. But since it lapsed in December, Horizon has been paying tariffs to the city government to move cargo. For reasons besides revenue, McLaughlin says that route is important.
You know, we hope that Matson recognizes that that domestic line haul service is really critical to Unalaska and our supply chain, and that that service level remains at least status quo.
While there could be some personnel changes in Alaska, Jeff Hull says Mattson will leave the actual shipping services intact. In Unalaska, that means Mattson will try to step into a partnership with Maersk, the international shipping giant. Maersk exports seafood using Horizon as its local agent, relying on laborers from the International Longshore and Warehouse Union. Mattson already has a contract with that union at other ports on the West Coast, according to Hull. The one thing that could change is Horizon's fleet. At almost 40 years old, the vessels are showing their age, and Hull says it might take some work to bring them up to speed with new air emissions regulations. It wouldn't happen until the deal between Mattson and Horizon is approved by federal trade regulators. The companies are expecting to hear back next year. In Unalaska, I'm Lauren Rosenthal.
The latest numbers show a state plan to truck North Slope natural gas to Fairbanks may not hit a targeted consumer price point. Officials updated the public on the project Wednesday, and as KUAC's Dan Bross reports, they're optimistic they can bring down the price.
The state-led Interior Energy Project is aimed at getting gas to Fairbanks consumers at a price equivalent to about half the cost of heating oil, but the latest estimate puts it 25% over target. Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority Energy Infrastructure Development Officer Nick Shimoniak provided the figure in response to an audience member question, cautioning it's not a final number.
We think that's the absolute ceiling. We think there's a lot of room to bring down the delivered price.
ADA is partnered with the private engineering firm MWH on the project, including the centerpiece North Slope Gas Processing Plant, a facility Shimoniak said is currently estimated to cost $233 million.
ADA, as well as MWH, believes that's probably too high of a price, and we think we can get that price down.
Shimoniak said ADA is working with MWH to adjust plant design and financial terms. The gas trucking project is supported in part by a $357 million state financing package, but substantial private capital is also required. MWH Alaska Managing Director Rick Adcock underscored the complexity of the project and the importance of getting all its moving parts to mesh.
This whole system has to work. Think about it. If you're the lender putting $100 million into this plant and you're doing your due diligence on this project, you're not going to lend in the plant unless you know someone at the other end is going to be turning on their thermostat and buying the gas. So you can't look at this piece by piece. The whole system, the whole supply chain has to work from the North Slope gas molecules to the burner tip in your home.
ADA's board of directors plans to make a decision on the project next month. It's already built a pad for the natural gas plant on the North Slope and targets getting first gas to Fairbanks by late 2016. Golden Valley Electric Association would be a primary customer, the nonprofit borough-run Interior Gas Utility, and private company Fairbanks Natural Gas would locally store and distribute the gas to homes and businesses within separate service areas. FNG laid over 33 miles of distribution pipe in the city of Fairbanks this summer and plans to add 30 more next summer. The IGU plans to order 80 miles of pipe next month. IGU board member and general manager Steve Haginson stressed the importance of consumers converting to gas as soon as their neighborhood is piped for service.
This is really what drives the entire cost stat per, when you look at it on a dollar per unit. If you start dropping the conversions, the cost per unit is going to go up. So we want to make sure that we have a very high level of conversions to ensure we keep the cost down as low as possible. So we're trying to do everything we can to incentivize and encourage conversions early on.
A gas conversion pilot program underway in North Pole involving 50 households is aimed at jump-starting the switchover and clarifying the cost. ADA estimates at between $2,500 and $10,000 per home, depending on its heating system. The state is also exploring low-interest financing options to help homeowners make the switch. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP Alaska, committed to the state of Alaska through investment, production, and jobs for future generations of Alaskans. More at alaska.bp.com. And by Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. Alaska Children's Trust, working to prevent child abuse and neglect by encouraging all Alaskans to take small steps that can make a big difference in the lives of Alaska's children. Information at alaskachildrenstrust.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Children's Trust.
Animal control officers have seized 12 emaciated husky dogs from a home in Girdwood. Officers yesterday also found a dog that had died at the home. Anchorage Animal Care and Control spokeswoman Laura Atwood says the animal control office received a tip by email that the dogs were being neglected.
The dogs were brought here to Anchorage Animal Care and Control Wednesday evening. They are in our care. They are being seen by a veterinarian today, and they are being cared for by our kennel staff.
Officers accompanied by Alaska State Troopers visited the home yesterday afternoon. Trooper spokeswoman Megan Peters says the matter is under investigation and troopers will have no further comment until the investigation is complete. No charges have been filed. Atwood says when officers reached the home, there was no owner present.
To the best of my knowledge, the owner was not present when the dog was taken.
She would not say how the dead dog had died. Atwood says Anchorage Animal Care and Control is ready to help if there is any suspicion of cruelty or neglect of domestic animals. The Kuskokwim River in southwest Alaska is experiencing a rare November breakup. Temperatures were cold in early November, but over the past several days, temperatures have reached into the 40s and even the 50s in some places along the river. KYUK's Daisha Eaton has more.
Selena Van Breuklin is a hydrologist with the National Weather Service and the River Forecast Center in Anchorage. She says they've had reports of the ice moving at Napaimute and at Aniak.
There seems to be some sort of a localized breakup that's happening at some locations on the river. We don't expect it to have a flood impact. We don't think that the ice is thick enough or that the water levels are high enough to really create a flood event. More of just some local breaking up that's happening.
The situation has thousands of residents in a transportation standstill as they wait for the Kuskokwim to freeze into a safe road for travel. Van Breuklin says the forecast calls for temperatures to begin dropping below freezing at night, and that should slow down melting.
That should help slow this process down a lot. Not expecting to see a lot of new precip that's going to add a significant amount of water into the river. And there shouldn't really be a lot more snow to melt. So not expecting to see much more inputs into the river over the next few days.
Mark Leary, who lives in Napaimute, says this is the third time he's seen a November breakup. Besides this year, it happened in 2002 and again in 2010. He says it's different than a spring one, especially how it sounds.
It sounds like rocks moving. There's no needle ice like in the springtime to soften some of the sound. Rocks tumbling down a hillside, rocks splitting, rocks grinding.
Leary says although the National Weather Service is not calling for flooding now, if ice jams form near villages and refreeze, it could mean trouble this spring.
That's what happened to Crooked Creek. You know, in 2010, it broke up in November, right around Thanksgiving, and then it jammed a few miles below their village and refroze. And boy, that jam was, you know, hard as a rock. So the next spring, 2011, that jam couldn't melt as fast as the regular ice, and that's what caused the new jam in the spring of 2011 that hit Crooked Creek really hard.
A pilot with the Alaska State Troopers flew the Kuskokwim River to assess the extent of the breakup and reports an ice jam below Aniak. National Weather Service officials say some local surges of water are expected as the ice runs. They say people should move belongings and equipment away from the river, but they don't expect high enough water to impact homes or roads. Alaska State Troopers are warning people not to travel on the river. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Tonight in Anchorage, the YWCA will present the 25th annual Women of Achievement Award to 10 Alaskan women who have helped others. Some as well-known newsmakers and others who have quietly gone about the tasks of improving the lives of those around them without much attention. Hillary Morgan is the YWCA's CEO. She says the women's advocacy organization has a theme for this year's event of honoring the past, inspiring the future.
And to give you an idea of some of our forward-moving initiatives, the YWCA Board of Directors resolved in August to eliminate the gender pay gap in Alaska by 2025, which I'm very excited about. We did a public announcement of that in September and have been working to get endorsements, and we're doing work to create a survey tool that companies can overlay over their personnel policies and their wage policies to determine whether they are a neutral, gender-neutral company. And in 2016, we hope to have a list beginning of sort of the best companies in Alaska for working women.
There's 10 women that will be honored, and some of the names are notable. But tell us about them. Tell us about who you've got this year.
We have well-known names like Senator Murkowski. Elvie Gray Jackson is one of our assemblywomen. And then you have names that aren't quite as well-known, like Natasha Masanovic is a professor at UAA, and she's a Serbian woman who has come over here and and is really a remarkable teacher, inspires her students, and propels them on to become amazing scholars and PhDs in their own right. And then you have folks like Phyllis Rhodes was the director of Identity, the LGBT center here, for about 10 or 12 years, and she did that totally volunteer. So those sorts of unsung heroes are really what the Women of Achievement is about, as well as honoring people whose accomplishments are more notable in town. This year, we're giving out the Arla Sturgiluski Award, which has only been given out 3 times in the 25-year history. The Women of Achievement Selection Committee determines that there's somebody who's so exceptional that they should get not only the Women of Achievement Award, but they should get this other award. And the woman who's getting that is Ruth Sheridan. She's 96 and has been working just time and a half for probably 90 of those years promoting justice, peace, and dignity for all human beings everywhere in the world, but has been in Alaska for quite some time doing it here. So it's really exciting to give her the Arla Sturgiluski Award.
Hillary Morgan is the Anchorage YWCA CEO. Tonight's Women of Achievement event in Anchorage will honor 10 outstanding Alaskan women. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Zachariah Hughes and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Annie Ropeek and Lauren Rosenthal in Unalaska, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Daisha Eaton in Bethel. APRN's Liz Ruskin reported from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing year-round transportation of all types of freight from vehicles and oversized equipment to small packages for corporations or small business. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. Salmon are all around us. They're in our rivers and our freezers. They fuel our economies and keep Alaskans connected to our traditions, our families, and our friends. The Salmon Project celebrates all the ways salmon are interwoven with our Alaskan lives. Learn more about the project and find out how you can be involved at salmonproject.org or find them on Facebook. Salmon, it runs deep in all Alaskans. This message sponsored by the Salmon Project.
Whether visiting Barrow or attending business in Juneau, APRN goes with listeners wherever they roam. Your company's message can span across Alaska on 26 stations. Find out how by calling 907-550-8437.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.